The Portland attorney who led the fight for gay marriage talks about her life's work and this week's unfolding news out of Washington. Mary Bonato has been fighting for rights for the LGBT community for a long time and has been a central figure in the historic effort to legalize gay marriage. 2 years ago, she successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Obergefell versus Hodges, establishing freedom to marry for same-sex couples. She has received a number of honors, including the MacArthur Prize and the Maine History Maker Award from the Maine Historical Society. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with Mary Bonato about the careful strategy she and her colleagues have followed to expand LGBT rights. And we'll discuss the president's newly announced transgender ban in the military and challenge to protections in the workplace. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In 2015, Mary Bonato argued before the United States Supreme Court that it is unconstitutional for states to ban same-sex marriage. It was a landmark case, and her victory before the nation's highest court is just one highlight in her long career fighting to eliminate discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Mary Bonato joins us today in Maine Calling. Mary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
As always, we want to hear from you and the audience. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Mary, I really want to ask you about your work over the past 27 years, about arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court, and your concerns for young people and others today. But first, we have to talk about the news of the day. In the past 30 hours, there have been two really important developments. First, yesterday, the president announced by tweet that he is instituting a ban against transgender Americans serving in the armed forces. Then this morning, we learned that the U.S. Justice Department has filed a brief in an employment discrimination case arguing that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act does not apply to employment based on sexual orientation. I'm going to take these one by one. Many people were surprised by the tweet, the transgender ban. Were you?
Yes, I was. I was surprised by the transgender ban. This is something that had been in process for over a year and supported by military leadership. In fact,
when you say in process, opposite.
Well, in process in the sense that the policy was announced, the policy would change. They had evaluated the fact that there had been so many transgender service members who had served with valor, willing to give their lives for their nation in the most patriotic way. The military is focused on readiness. There were studies that were commissioned by the military, by the RAND Corporation, saying this works. And so as a result of that, up to like about 15,000 people came out as transgender. And now there's a threat of those people being removed from the military.
Have you been hearing from transgender people who are serving in the military since that tweet? And if so, what are you hearing from them?
Yes, we are hearing both from people who are in the process of enlistment, and we want to hear from more of them. We are also hearing from people who are in the military who are now wondering if they're going to remain welcome there. And frankly, we think an exclusion of this nature is discriminatory. We plan to file suit.
That's what I was going to ask. There are already talks of lawsuits. Your organization, GLAAD, is going to be one of those?
That is correct. We are going to be filing a lawsuit, both with respect to whether transgender people are denied the ability to enlist, as well as removing those who are already part of the military.
Let's talk about the other news, the Justice Department brief. What do you know about the New York case?
The New York case is one of many that has been around the nation where what is happening is that both gay people and transgender people are saying, even though it would be very helpful to have a non-discrimination law passed by the Congress that specifically states sexual orientation and gender identity are not a permissible basis for discriminating and firing somebody just because of who they are. You know, it's been since the 1970s that such bills have been kicking around. And in the meantime, a lot has happened in the courts and with the Congress over sex discrimination law. And sex discrimination law, in other words, the requirement that someone not be fired because of sex, for example, has for many years now been interpreted to include gender in the sense of you don't meet a particular stereotype. And what has happened is that the legal arguments have sort of been reexamined and refocused in the courts to make two points, both with respect to gender identity and sexual orientation. One point being, how can you, if you're thinking, oh my goodness, this person is not a real man, or oh my God, this is a lesbian and why is she involved with a woman, you're immediately thinking about sex. You're thinking about, you know, who they are, who they're supposed to be in your mind. And so that literally, because of sex, this is discrimination if you terminate or harass somebody on that basis. And then secondly, the gender issue is around sex stereotyping. And that's an area where women definitely led the way because they were sort of caught in a double bind of, you know, couldn't be too aggressive and so on. But in any event, the courts are very, very clear that the sex discrimination laws are supposed to strike at the entire spectrum of discrimination, including stereotypes. And when it comes to gender identity, for example, you know, the idea is what? You're not a real man. You're not a real woman. You're, you know, you say you are, but you're really not. And then likewise, with respect to gay people, the idea is, well, you know, a woman is supposed to have her primary relationship in life with a man. A man is supposed to have his primary relationship with a woman. And that is, you know, a stereotype because it's certainly not true for certain people. And so those are both because of sex.
How important is this news? Is this Justice Department brief in this one New York case?
Well, we've been winning many of these cases in recent times, and particularly the whole Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is not exactly a liberal circuit, recently ruled that they were going to overturn previous precedents and accept the theories that were advanced because they're correct. So this brief takes aim at the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit just recently issued an opinion saying, okay, we're bound by our precedents, but we want to have our full court, everybody, participate. And that's what this next case is. The brief was just filed in. So the Second Circuit, which covers New York, Vermont, and Connecticut, is now hearing that issue. So this is important because, of course, this is our national government essentially saying that discrimination against some people is permissible, even though there are definitely very legitimate arguments for saying why sexual orientation and gender identity should be covered as because of sex. But anyway, that position is going to get sorted out in courts. And I feel actually quite strongly that these arguments are sound. And, you know, the DOJ can weigh in. It's, you know, right to do so. But I think they're wrong. And I think we're going to have the better of the argument.
During the campaign, we heard a lot of mixed messages from now President Trump. But now his Justice Department has done something very clear. You weren't surprised by this. The brief and the
No, I'm not surprised by the brief. And I guess from my perspective, even though the president and his cabinet haven't, quote unquote, gone after gay people the way they have with like the, you know, ban from predominantly Muslim countries and so on, they've been doing a death by a thousand cuts approach. So there are surveys that used to acknowledge that there are gay and transgender people and ask about their health or ask about their age and, you know, the Older Americans Act, those things have all been being stripped out of the census. I mean, you know, you don't count if you're not counted. And I remember how surprised I was when we started being counted. We're going to go back to being, if the administration has its way, invisible. You know, we had also that very high-profile issue with the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and Betsy DeVos, Education Secretary, arguing over whether to withdraw the guidance on transgender youth and that they should be respected at school as part of, again, sex discrimination and the prohibition on sex discrimination in publicly funded schools. So we've seen plenty of things coming down the pike already. There's more that have made me feel like we're so not done.
Since 2015, when you argued Obergefell versus Hodges before the United States Supreme Court, there's been a lot of celebrating, and you've been really recognized, not just here in the United States, but you're on your way to Japan. People really want to hear what you have to say, Mary. Have you been living sort of with this, you know, how should I say, dichotomy, where you feel really proud of the progress that you and your colleagues have made, but also with a little undercurrent of worry and fear?
Well, absolutely. The undercurrent of worry and fear remains. And in fact, I was one of those voices after the victory to, of course, celebrate it. And at the same time, say there is so much work to be done. And of course, it's coming to light, as it we knew it would, that people can get married on Friday in some states and then fired on Monday. And that just as there have been people who were resisting marriage, resist non-discrimination laws and so on, they haven't stopped. And so now we're dealing with a whole range of attempts to use religion as a grounds for discriminating, but in public businesses, commercial contexts, by government employees, things that normally you would think of are just clearly out of bounds. So, of course, I'm worried. But I will say that for me, in some ways, one of the greatest things about the marriage ruling, aside from all the joy it has unleashed coast to coast and the security for families, is reading this report that came out fairly recently about the youth suicide rate going down, and so much of that being attributable to the fact that so many more young people feel hope about their futures because they now know they're going to age into a society that will respect their life partner choices.
Let's go back to 1990. That's when you took the job at GLAAD. 25 years later, you were arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court in defense of the right of same-sex couples to marry. I understand that right from the beginning, people wanted to go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you were one of the voices that said no. Why?
Yes, that's right. In my first week on the job,
really,
GLAAD,
your
in
first
1990,
week on the job, I didn't know that. Yeah.
I received a call from a couple who'd been together 10 years and wanted to file a marriage lawsuit. You know, at that time, I had moved from Maine to Massachusetts to take the job that I still have at GLAAD to enforce a non-discrimination law that was threatened to go on the ballot for repeal. At that point, Mass was the second state in the nation to have a non-discrimination law. It was considered radical and militant, even though I think now we understand that non-discrimination is it's a good thing for everybody. So in any event, I didn't think it was the right time, and I did believe that people needed to sort of see that, see more about who gay people are and our families and calm down about the non-discrimination law and sort of get a better handle and more information before people would be able to process the issue as a fairness issue. Because I do believe deeply in the fairness of people in this nation. It's partly, I think, being nurtured on the Pledge of Allegiance and liberty and justice for all. But I also think it's the history of our Constitution, and that's what Justice Ginsburg says, that that's the history of our Constitution is the story of including people who were once ignored and excluded.
What do you think you gave you that insight when others within the movement were wanting to go faster, to go more incremental and work state by state in the beginning?
I don't know. To me, it seemed pretty obvious that you can't go from point A to point Z. You have to go from point A to point B. You can try to push hard and fast to point A, B, and beyond, but that you needed to go through the process.
How important was Maine's referendum?
Maine's referendum was extremely important. And, you know, again, you mentioned all the credit that I get. I want to be really clear that I feel like I'm a stand-in. All these awards I get, I say time and again, I am a stand-in for the millions of people who made this happen across the nation, including here in my home state of Maine, where I, you know, there are too many people who worked way too hard for me to hog all the credit. So I think Maine was super important for a number of reasons. I mean, number one, just the sort of grassroots campaign we had here with people from all walks of life and all ages who were so committed, you know, as a matter of their faith, as because of their who their kids are, you know, out there canvassing, going door to door in the state, and particularly where we had lost narrowly in 2009, to see that Mainers could reevaluate the information, think about it. You know, hear that many more voices, have those discussions that so many people had at their doors, and realize that maybe they should change their minds, that they were on a journey and they were open to fairness. I think it's important, and Maine is unique in this, in being a state that voted one way, reconsidered, and then changed its mind. That gives me great hope for the future, and it's a lesson I don't want anyone to forget.
And wasn't Maine the first state to legalize same-sex marriage by referendum as opposed to through the legislature or the courts?
Absolutely correct. And again, you know, I remember when we started on the marriage issue, people would say, you're never going to win in court. And we won in court. And they said, well, you're never going to win in the legislature. And we won the legislature. They said, you'll never win with the people. And it was important to win with each branch of government, especially with the court of public opinion.
I understand that you found out you'd be arguing in front of the Supreme Court less than a month before it happened. Is that true?
That is true.
What did you do?
Well, you know, GLAAD focuses on New England, although we also work nationally when necessary and when we can really add something. And New England was in great shape on marriage, and we had you know, helped to take down the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013 so that people's marriages were now respected by the federal government. So I thought I was going to do some other things, but the calls started pouring into GLAAD right away that we needed to get back on the field and help in other states. And so we did. We helped all over the nation. And I was asked to join the Michigan team, which was going to trial, and I helped them. Although, again, I don't want to take anything away from them because the lawyers did a great job. And the couple involved, April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, you know, they're unbelievable. And I'm sorry, I know I'm jumping around, but I just have to say something about them.
Sure.
Because, you know, these are two women who are nurses. One's an emergency room nurse. One's a neonatal intensive care nurse and in different hospitals. And they were meeting children who essentially were abandoned by their families, by their parents, and often born drug addicted. And the first child they took into their home was somebody who had been so ill at birth, the doctors sent the boy home with them to die. But they nursed him back to health. He's now the eldest of their five children. And they have five children who were intensely vulnerable, who they took into their homes, and they have raised and continue to raise and love these children who are flourishing. And so I found them incredibly inspirational as a couple. And the reason I was asked to join the Michigan team was because they had been asked by the court to go to trial and to prove that gay people could be good parents. You know, which I hope we don't have to go prove that again, since, you know, so much of what matters is the love and the relationship between a parent and child. But what better situation to go forward on? Anyway, so I know I digressed. I didn't answer the rest of your question, but I just had to say these are the kinds of remarkable people I've met in Maine and all over the nation at this point. Okay, you asked me about the timing. Anyway, I never expected to argue. This was Michigan's thing. I was helping. I was happy to be helping. But in the end, you know, somebody had to argue the marriage question, and there were a lot of counsel who wanted to do it. And in the end, I was the only person everyone could agree on. So it was me. And, you know, I'm an over-preparer. So on the one hand, I was thrilled, but I was also thinking, like, I wish I'd had more time.
Was that your first case before the Supreme Court?
Yes, it was my first case before the Supreme Court. And we also knew it was going to be an unbelievably hot bench, which it was. And that
when you say a hot bench, you mean they were going to push back?
They were going to push constantly, and they did. And that's okay. That's part of our system. I knew going into that, you know, there were four states involved with lots of couples and widows and widowers, and we were at great briefs, and there were dozens and dozens of friend of the court briefs from, like, all of the, you know, important, relevant, authoritative organizations in the country on our side. You know, I just knew that we had everything that we needed on paper, but there is this showtime that happens at the Supreme Court, and I was honored to be able to stand there. And frankly, here's another thing. After I sat down, the next person to stand up on behalf of these couples in these cases and nationwide was the Solicitor General of the United States. The United States of America was on our side, something I had never thought I would see.
We do have to take our first break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking with civil rights lawyer Mary Bonato. Please stay with us.
Well, I'm privileged to be the chairman of the board of Maine Public. And we are a volunteer board, and we come from many different walks of life. We have many different interests, but we're united in our passion for the mission of Maine Public. And the mission of Maine Public is to connect this very geographically large and diverse state together, pull it together with radio, with television, with quality programming, with classical music. It's really amazing what we do. And that's what unites us on the board. And that's really what drives the whole support for Maine Public. But we wouldn't have it without donors. Without donors across the state, you're a critical part of it, and we thank you. We just thank you very much for this wonderful support over all these years. I'm Ron Bancroft from Cumberland, Maine. Thank you for supporting Maine Public's bold future.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, civil rights lawyer Mary Bonato joining me in our studio in Portland. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Mary, so much of the conversation has been about gay marriage and then more recently about transgender bathrooms, but there's also really quietly been changes being made in the rights of gay, lesbian, transgender parents, hasn't there?
There has, and this is extremely important for non-gay people, even more than gay people, because there's simply more non-gay people. You know, 50 years ago, our nation decided, both as a matter of policy and constitutional law, that we were not going to disadvantage children because of the circumstances of their birth, that if they were born to, among other things, unmarried parents, they should not be deprived of rights that would otherwise come to children by virtue of their parents' marriage. And that principle is as important today as it's ever been. So in Maine and a number of states, but in Maine in particular, there has been an effort to really update Maine's family law and to make sure that, for example, if a child is born to an unmarried couple and they first of all, let me start with marriage. Normally, when you're a child born to a married couple, that child is presumed to be the child of both spouses, and that's protection. Your parentage is clear from the outset. There are circumstances sometimes for changing it, but the Maine Parentage Act really is going to limit that to, you know, some timelines and so on. But for unmarried couples who have children, and that's not quite the majority here, but pushing it, and the same thing is true nationally, you know, children of unmarried parents also deserve protection. And so one of the vehicles for doing that, for example, in the Maine Parentage Act, and this is not a majority rule, but a very common rule around the country now, is something like if you've held your child out together, you know, you and the birth parent hold the child out together as your child for 2 years. You take responsibility for that child. After 2 years, nobody can come in and say, actually, that's my child. That's your child. That's your child, and that's good for the child from a perspective of maintaining that relationship. The person who's been responsible for you, that continuity, crucial for children. And at the same time, you know, respecting, if necessary, if there's a genetic parent who says, actually, it's me, and they come in time, then so be it. Then that will be another thing. But crucial for children to have that protection and security and know they're going to have a forever family.
And I don't think a lot of people realize that until very, very recently, same-sex couples would only be able to have one parent on the birth certificate.
That is right, unless they had an adoption procedure that they did together in Maine. In 2007, the Maine Law Court ruled that unmarried couples, which included all same-sex couples at that time.
2007, still pretty recent.
Right. Am I right about that? Yeah, that is 2007. Could jointly adopt. That's right. And it's been a real burden and a real hardship on families. It's made, I think, children feel that they don't have the same security that other children have. And, you know, heaven forfend that, you know, the quote-unquote legal parent dies, becomes disabled and so on, or that the non-legal parent, as we have to call them coldly, dies. You know, that child's not entitled to the Social Security protections that would otherwise arise and so on. So it's just been a rotten deal for kids, and it was time for Maine to update its laws.
And is Maine on the forefront?
Maine is, you know, there's ways in which Maine is on the forefront because that Maine Parentage Act that was developed by the Family Law Advisory Commission with some outside help was just recently looked to very seriously as a model for something called the Uniform Parentage Act, which is put together by experts from every state that was just approved within the last month and looks very intensely at many of the mechanisms that Maine created as a very appropriate balance of the children's rights, you know, the parents' rights and so on. And one of the, I think, one of the great innovations of the Maine Parentage Act, too, is how simple it made made everything for people when they use assisted reproduction, which many, you know, non-gay people do and gay people, to have children. Just to clarify, a donor is not a parent. Who are the parents? You can have that ascertained, when you can have that ascertained and so on. So the bottom line is this should reduce disputes and it should secure responsibilities and protection for a child right away.
Before we go to the calls, and we have several, I want to ask you, Mary, the Supreme Court that you argued in front of 2 years ago has since changed with the death of Antonin Scalia and the now Neil Gorsuch is a Supreme Court justice. Do you think there would have been a different outcome? And what do you think of Neil Gorsuch?
I think Neil Gorsuch would have voted the same way that Justice Scalia did. So I don't, you know, he's more concerned. You know, if you look at his records, and I've read several dozen of his opinions, and I've read a lot about him, he would tilt even more conservative than Justice Scalia. So I think I'm confident the result would have been the same. And in terms of what I think about him, I think he seems like a very nice person, and he writes very well. But I also, based on having read some of his other writings, it's not clear that he really believes in sort of, you know, liberty rights that sometimes are called privacy rights around things like contraception and protecting private sexual intimacy and so on. I think those are the cases that are going to be very concerning with him.
We'll go to Derek, who's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Derek. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with Mary Bonato.
Hi, Ms. Bonato. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling, first of all, to say that you're definitely an inspiration. Someone who is about to become a law student next fall. I'm applying to law schools this fall. My main question was, I guess, someone who hopes to use their law degree to pursue the defense of civil rights cases and things like that, or where would you steer a prospective student and or a graduating student as far as legal practice goes?
Well, I would say that a law degree is an incredible tool to be used, that can be used for all kinds of good work. And in that vein, like if you practice family law, if you practice criminal law, if you practice in civil rights law, if you in any number of areas of law, there are issues of justice that emerge. And one of the things I always encourage people to do is to reach out to lawyers, organizations that spend all their time thinking about these things and say, I've got this interesting case. What do you think? Because I will tell you that many of the cases that we bring are cases that have initially been brought to us by private attorneys who want to be able to team up. And we've had many successful collaborations with private attorneys. I will also say that you can do very good work through the government, whether it's state or the federal government. And that's another thing to think about in terms of, you know, quote unquote, the public interest. And I would also say, you know, if you do corporate law, and I've worked with corporate lawyers, by the way, who are awesome. But if you did corporate law, which I'm, you know, just going to stereotype as being not particularly related to these fields, there's also all kinds of organizations who need lawyers on their boards as advisors, as people who can, you know, bring resources and run down issues quickly. So there are just so many ways to help. And part of it depends on what kind of life you want to lead and where your passions bring you once you finish law school.
Derek, thanks for your call and good luck to you in your application process. We're going to move on to Ted, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Ted. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, Jennifer. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I just wanted to congratulate your guest, Ms. Bonato, on the inspirational and really courageous work they've done.
Thank you.
My question is, as Jennifer knows, I teach government to high school students. And when we do the unit on the judiciary, what we hear a lot is that some of these cutting issues, and I'm referring now to President Trump's ban on transgender serving in the military, is before the Supreme Court can take it, it's got to percolate a while in the lower courts. So if I understand correctly, GLAD is probably going to sue the government over this ban, but how long would it actually take, do you think, to reach the Supreme Court?
Well, first of all, I guess I have to hold out a tiny bit of hope that it won't come to be. From what I understand, this whole idea, this tweet came out in part as a way of trying to effectuate a budget deal. You know, the rationales for the new ban are disruption, which is basically saying we don't want to have transgender people here, but that's not really exactly a good reason when there's so many courageous, valorous transgender people who've already been serving. The money issue was raised. That is actually laughable in terms of what a pathetically, infinitesimally small part of the budget we're talking about. And under the guidelines that had been developed in the previous administration, in order to join the military, you would have had to have, quote unquote, completed your transition and have no medical needs other than ongoing hormone therapy. So, frankly, we don't think there's any basis for this policy whatsoever. So I'd like to think that maybe cooler heads will eventually prevail because, again, a tweet is not a policy yet. So there's that. But then should it happen, I do think that there are organizations like ours, if it actually hits the ground, who will sue and, frankly, will try to get nationwide injunctions right away. to keep the thing from going into effect. Now, of course, when it comes to the military, the president is given enormous authority. We are definitely on the more vulnerable side of that, and I recognize that. But we're also on the side of right. So your question was about timing. You know, if we had a nationwide, if some organization that sues were able to obtain a nationwide injunction, that's the kind of thing that I think could move through the courts a little bit more quickly. But we're still looking at time here. We're still looking at time. And I'd like to think we could also, you know, maybe I'm just way too ahead of myself here and too much in love with my own arguments, but I'd like to think we could prevent the discharge of people who have been serving and who added themselves in reliance on this, you know, again, time and again, to the support of their commanding officers, and that we could, you know, prevent at least that kind of harm in the meantime as well.
Ted, thanks for your call.
Thank
we'll
you,
move to Waterville and Ellery. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Yes, Ms. Bedondo, thank you so much for the work you do. It is greatly appreciated. Curious about the LGBTQ issue within the military, and I'm wondering, since it was all fine and okay and everything, everyone was welcomed and everyone can come out, as it were, once this has transpired, one cannot become un-out. And thus, is this a way to categorize or round up people, classifying people? I'm concerned about that. Anyway, that leads to my question, which is, have the rules, state by state, county by county, been changing for rights or more restrictive of rights, as from your position of viewing so many states' legislatures?
Okay, great questions there, Ellery. With respect to rounding up people and the unfairness of, you know, to people who've outed themselves in this process, I do think, again, that that's a basis for trying to prevent any policy, which we don't have yet, from going into effect. And with respect to how states are proceeding on non-discrimination, you know, the ironic thing is that for many years now, there has been overwhelming public support for non-discrimination. You know, I'm talking about in the 80s percents. And nonetheless, in state legislatures and at the Congress, things are much slower. So we are in a position now where fewer than half the states have non-discrimination laws explicitly about sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, some of that is because some states have no non-discrimination laws whatsoever, you know, Georgia, Mississippi, whatever. But fewer than half the states have done this. Now, at the same time, when you sort of do the whole patchwork, as of course I do, of thinking about, well, what states have executive orders from the governor saying we're not going to discriminate in state employment, and you add in the states with non-discrimination laws, and you add in the states that are now covered by a ruling that says sex discrimination includes sexual orientation and gender identity, you start getting close to half of the U.S. population being covered. But it's a patchwork, for sure. And from our perspective, the clearest and cleanest thing that would provide the most protection and the most clarity, including for landlords and for employers, is just to say it. And just to say, when it comes to hiring, when it comes to renting and selling, we're not going to discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And in that vein, I just want to say that there have now been 4 court decisions from the Supreme Court over the last 20 years. And frankly, that's the message coming from them. Time and again, it has been gay people are historically discriminated against, and they should be treated equally. They should have the same liberties as everyone else. So I wish we could translate that on the policy side as well.
Ellery, thanks so much for your call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Mary, earlier in the program, you mentioned the suicide rate for young people going down, which is, you know, of course, wonderful news, but you still are very concerned about LGBT young people, aren't you?
I am concerned about LGBT young people. I'm concerned about all young people, actually. Maybe the parenting brings it out even that much more. But I'm concerned about LGBT young people because it's still really clear that the status of being LGBT is contested in our nation. You know, it's why we don't have non-discrimination laws everywhere. And particularly now when you see things coming out of the current administration that, for example, rescind a guidance to schools saying respect who these students are when they're at school. You know, it concerns people. I mean, thankfully in Maine, we have, through the Human Rights Act, protections for young people in schools based on gender identity and sexual orientation, but that's not true everywhere. And I think the rhetoric that sometimes people advance when they talk about gay people, the objections, the moral objections and so on, are frightening. And so there are a lot of young people who struggle with depression and feel rejected. You know, I've learned and come to understand more of the data about what happens when young people come out, because more and more people are coming out to their parents at younger ages. And there's an astonishing amount of rejection that occurs. The idea that you'll, I mean, frankly, even the idea that you'll grow out of it is rejecting, because it's not saying that what you're telling me is real and that I need to support that. Of course, there's other types of rejecting behavior, too, which are much more extreme. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that really harms a child, is much more likely to lead to ultimately involvement with DHHS, with running away, with other unproductive behaviors for the youth. So, yes, I am worried about how we get to a place where we just stop pathologizing LGBT people and youth, because that message to them simply harms them. You know, I don't want to lose another generation of gay people. And I'm concerned that youth are far more vulnerable than we realize. And I want to give one example, actually, one thing that people can do productively, if I may. So for many years now, there's been something called the Rainbow Ball up in Machias, the University of Maine at Machias. And it's a ball where, like, one day a year, these LGBT youth from all parts of rural Maine are able to converge and relax and be themselves and celebrate. Well, it's outgrown its facilities. And so it's now going to be at Mount Desert Island High School. And they're needing to raise money for transportation for youth. Anybody who wants to support that effort, please send a check to the Mount Desert Island High School for the Rainbow Ball, because it's vital that these youth can think about this all year, talk to their friends about it all year, and look forward to being together.
We have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Maine Public is teaming up with Darlings and Literacy Volunteers of Bangor to share the joy of reading with children across Maine. Many Maine children have limited access to appropriate books, so Maine Public is collecting new books and pristine used books at Darlings and Maine Public locations. These books will be distributed at many of the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause stops and also at two special literacy events, including this Saturday the 29th from 11 until 2 at Darlings Chrysler Dodge Ram Hyundai dealership at 439 Western Avenue in Augusta. The event will include Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz, who will read to the children, photo opportunities with Clifford the Big Red Dog, the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause truck, and other fun activities. For more information and all the details, including how to donate books, please visit mainpublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Mary Bonato joins me to talk about equality for the LGBTQ community. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our number again, 1-800-399-3566. Mary, other than everything else we've talked to up to this point, what projects are you working on at GLAAD?
I'm not going to keep you here for an hour, so I'll just say two things I think that are worth mentioning that might be of interest to other people. One is that GLAAD, working with the law firm Ropes and Gray, has something we call the Pop-Up Identity Document Project. And what that means is anyone from Maine can call us, 1-800-455-GLAAD, and about identity documents, and we will help them get identity documents for free with a lawyer.
What does that mean, identity documents?
Well, it's things like changing your birth certificate, your driver's license, you know, all the things that sort of facilitate life and identify who you are. And we've even begun looking to people who've previously married, but during the course of their marriage, you know, came out as transgender, to have those records corrected as well. So there are procedures for doing all of this, you know, and people are welcome to call us. Parents are welcome to call us about their children.
We've talked about your argument before the U.S. Supreme Court in Obergefell versus Hodges. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
You sure are.
And I think a lot of people believe, okay, we've walked through that door. We've closed it behind us. Is it that simple? Is the right for same-sex couples to marry now secure, or is it still vulnerable?
Well, technically, it's vulnerable, although I want to say the thing that I believe makes rights enduring is when they're accepted in people's hearts. And I realize we will never have 100% of hearts, but it's, you know, public opinion has only increased in terms of its support for marriage in every demographic group, including Protestants and evangelicals and Republicans. And for millennials, they're all about equality. So on the one hand, there is that piece. On the other hand, this was a Supreme Court decision. And as the court composition changes, you know, I think people who oppose marriage are very clear that, as they put it, this is a numbers game, and they would like to find justices that would reverse it. You have to remember, this was a 5-4 decision. There were 4 dissents that said the Constitution has nothing to do with this. And with a 5th justice, we would be vulnerable. Okay, terrifying. Stop right there for a second. I will also say that in law, there is this principle called stare decisis, meaning the thing has been decided. And when it has been decided, what you would need in order for the courts to retain their legitimacy is not just we feel differently, but some new information or research or perspective that says it's worth unsettling something so important as people's marriages and families. I don't think you could undo existing marriages, but in terms of barring them going forward. And I'd like to think that, number one, people will come, you know, the people who don't agree, you know, some of them will never change their minds, but some will. And that people will understand that this is here to stay. It's part of what Americans now count on, is being able to marry the person that they choose.
How about on the ground, though? I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of attention given to, I believe it was a court clerk in Missouri who was not, what, do I have the right state, who just refused?
Yeah, it was Kim Davis in Kentucky.
Kentucky, that's right.
It's okay. Well, there are going to be people like that, okay, who refuse to, you know, who refuse to do their jobs. And there are states that are trying to accommodate those people, those government clerks that normally just deal with the whole public as part of their jobs. But that's really still a minority. What there is, on the other hand, if there have been a couple of lawsuits from, you know, really engineered by states saying we don't have to provide the same birth certificates, we don't have to provide the same employment benefits. And actually, one of these cases recently was decided by the Supreme Court in a summary fashion, like very quickly without full briefing. And the Supreme Court reversed and said we were clear in the Obergefell opinion that same-sex couples are entitled to the same constellation of benefits and protections as every other married person is. That includes birth and death certificates, includes employment benefits, it includes everything. That said, so that answered that issue, you would think. However, a court recently disagreed with them on the birth certificate issue, and the Texas Supreme Court recently issued an opinion saying, well, this issue around employment benefits for Houston employees, we're going to send it back to a lower court. So we are going to continue to have to fight this sort of, you know, rear guard action to sort of hurt, you know, to take down Obergefell with, you know, 1,000 cuts. The law right now is really with us, and the opinion couldn't be clearer that this is a question of having the same liberty to marry the person you choose. And likewise, this is about equality, because to shut gay people out of marriage because of who they are, they're not going to marry somebody of the opposite sex, means to deny them all kinds of protections for their family and for their children.
We'll go to Kevin, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Mary, for all the work you've been doing.
Thank you.
Today in the Advocate is an article talking about a filing that came in from the Department of Justice. I guess it's called a friend of the court brief. In a case that involves whether federal civil rights law discriminates based on sexual discrimination. And the department argued it does not. And this has to do with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. And, you know, is this another way, is this a sort of a backdoor way for this administration to take away the rights of the LGBT community?
Kevin, thanks. We talked about this briefly at the beginning of the program, but go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, and Kevin, thank you for that cogent explanation of what's going on. I appreciate that. Yeah, the department took the position. I only briefly reviewed the brief. They took the position that discrimination means discrimination between men and women. And what they're missing is that this whole line of Supreme Court case law and other case law saying, well, when you talk about because of sex, that also means gender and it means stereotypes. And if you are terminating somebody because you don't think they're a real man or that real men should date women, I'm sorry, that's included in because of sex. And I do think we have the better of that argument. But yeah, the United States is now on the other side.
Kevin, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Jack, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. God's law overrules homosexual law. You are mentally ill.
All right. So, Mary, what do you say to people who cite their religious beliefs in opposition to gay marriage?
I would say it's, you know, absolutely your right to feel that way. You know, I'm not sure any data would make any difference to you, but I would say that the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and many others have said that being gay or lesbian is just part of a normal range of human sexuality, and it implies no deficiency or illness of any sort. And frankly, I think if you look around, you just see so many LGBT people who are huge contributors to our society, and you know, I'd like to think that we all want stronger communities and stronger families, and inclusion is definitely a way to get there.
Going from Jack in Brunswick to Lois in Portland. Go ahead, Lois. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Hi, Mary. this is actually, I'm from South Portland. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, as a member of the legislature, which I am, what it is that I might do in the next regular session that would help further the cause of LGBT citizens in Maine.
Thank you, Representative Reckitt, and real admirer of your work outside of the legislature and certainly in the legislature as well. Well, I think one thing to consider is that this is in the next session, but it's the next year or whatever you call it. I believe there's going to be a bill to ban what they call conversion therapy, the idea that you take a young person under 18 who is gay and try to convince them that they're not gay. There's a lot of research out there about how harmful this is to try to change someone's sexual orientation. At this point, there's longitudinal data about it as well. And this is the sort of thing that I think about we have to just stop making people ashamed for who they are. So I do think that that bill, which I believe is going to be led by Representative Fecteau, is one of those things, one of those positive things, certainly worth working for. And on the other hand, I think to the extent that there's any attempt to cut into the Human Rights Act or, you know, that kind of thing, that's something to prevent.
Mary, are there other states that have similar laws already in place banning conversion therapy?
Yes, there are. I think we're about 9 or 10 at this point. Connecticut just came online unanimously, close to unanimously, with a bill this year to ban conversion therapy. And again, the stories are wrenching of how people, you know, blame themselves. It's disruptive to family relationships because often these therapists try to get you to blame your parents and how you were raised. But in the end, it makes you hate yourself. And that is not exactly a strong foundation for being able to go forward as a healthy person.
Lois, thanks for your call. We'll go to Gerald calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Gerald. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I just caught the tail end of your program. I just had to call in because, you know, I've got a bunch of friends in the community, things like that. And the thing that really kind of throws me off about this is, legally, you know, why does it matter? Man, woman, it doesn't even matter if you're a couple. It's just a contract saying, you know, we're joining together, we're sharing our resources, we're sharing our insurance and benefits and things like that. And just leave ethics, morality, all of that off the table.
So you're talking about marriage, Gerald?
Yes, marriage and other equality rights, yes.
Gerald, are you saying why is it important? Why does it matter for gay and lesbian people to have the right to marry somebody of the same sex?
Well, I'm saying why is it even an issue? Why shouldn't it just be an automatic default thing? Why is it something that's being fought?
Right. Okay. We'll see if this you can tell me if I'm on the wrong track here in answering your question, Gerald. Part of it has to do with just, in fact, a very long history of discrimination against LGBT people in the nation. You know, just in the 20th century, you know, people were rounded up It was considered an illness for which there was treatment for a period of time. You couldn't serve in the military openly. There was a time when the federal government, you know, removed any suspected gay person from employment. I mean, you can go on and on. And I think this idea that there's something wrong and bad about being gay, that there's a legacy of that. It's not all cured, for example, by the marriage decision. So what that means is that there are a lot of people who have negative attitudes about gay people, or there's enough of them that it can cause problems, getting people fired from their jobs, losing homes, treating people badly at work, at school. And so that you do, in our nation, we have decided that there are times when government's going to say, as part of fair treatment, we have to say it's not okay to make decisions on particular bases based on who people are because of their gender, their race, their sexual orientation. And so I think that's part of why this becomes an issue, is because there has been moral condemnation. There has been rejection. And, you know, in our laws, at least, we all come before our government as equals. And so the law is in a position to be able to say some of those attitudes have to be off limits in particular contexts, like when it comes to getting service from the government, or when it comes to places that are open for everybody, they should be open for everybody.
Gerald, thanks for your call. Going to Amy in Rockport. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say thank you real quick to Mary for all her hard work over the years for the LGBTQ community in Maine. And I've just been listening to your program, and I heard a few people just sort of asking where they could put their energy, I don't know, in terms of donations or volunteer work. But I'm a board member for Out Maine. We're an LGBTQ youth organization in Rockland. And we just, you know, we work towards creating safer community spaces, building safer schools in Mid-Coast Maine. So, you know, folks can definitely find out information at outmaine.org.
Great. Amy, I invite you to go to the Maine Calling Facebook page and post information. And I'm going to move on to Tammy in Charleston. Tammy, we're almost out of time. So if you could make your comment brief, that would be great.
Okay. Coming from a Christian perspective, what we taught our children is that God creates each individual, whatever their color, sexual origin, culture, and who are we to judge God's work. And I told our kids, rather, we are here to support and love one another.
Tammy, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Well, and that's going to be the last call. Mary Bonato, thank you so much for being here. Mary Bonato is a lawyer and civil rights advocate who argued the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision to allow same-sex marriage. She's the civil rights director for GLAAD, and she is a Mainer. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional technical help from Jonathan Woodward. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.